Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Mexico's foreign minister is meeting with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo today as Mexico and the U.S. try to reach an agreement over immigration and tariffs. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador and his government negotiators are trying to delicately negotiate its way out of looming U.S. tariffs. But many fear that its talks with the Trump administration could break down, leading to a backlash here and long-term damage to the bilateral relationship. For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He's a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Always glad to be here.
So Trump has threatened to impose tariffs starting at 5% and gradually rising to 25% on all Mexican exports to the United States unless Mexican authorities prevent U.S.-bound Central Americans from crossing their country. Is this really negotiating bluster, or do you expect that Trump would do something as ridiculous as this?
Well, I expect the latter. And why? Is this just about economics? I mean, the amount of trade going back and forth between Mexico and the U.S. is as large as the amount of trade between China and the U.S. Mexico is a big customer, and 80% of all Mexican exports go to the U.S. So this really puts Mexico in a very, fragile position, and they know it, and that's why they're willing to concede. But what's behind this, of course, on the surface is immigration, right? It's a threat that you do something about immigration. But I think it goes deeper than that. Look, I think this is really about election 2020. This is about, and you're going to see more and more of this by Trump, beating up all these other countries with threats of tariffs and so forth to resurrect his economic nationalist theme that was so so productive for him in the last election. Everything this guy does from this point on is going to be election 2020 oriented. But it goes even deeper than election 2020. Consider this. Consider that, reportedly the U.S. has, with its tariffs on China and $250 billion to China, produced about $100 billion in tariff revenues. And even more once the other $300 billion are imposed. I think what this is about is Trump raising money from tariffs, which will enable him to bypass the U.S. House of Representatives that's supposed to raise funds and earmark what's the spending going to be on. We got a constitutional crisis with Trump bypassing the House of Representatives, the power of the person in the House, raising money himself for his own purposes. He's raising money with these tariffs that he says he's going to continue with Mexico to fund his wall. And therefore, look like, see, I told you folks in 2020 I was going to build the wall. So this is all mixed up. It's not just economics. It's not just election. It's not just immigration. It's part of the constitutional crisis. It's part of building the wall.
How does this benefit Trump in 2020 if tariffs are really taxes, and by implementing these tariff/taxes, the cost of my tomato, the cost of my avocado, and the cost of at Chipotle just went up 15%?
Yeah, but, this guy doesn't really care about the rest of the economy. He cares about his election first and foremost. And he'll use some of the tariff money to sort of placate the businesses that are affected, not the consumers, but the businesses. I mean, look what he's done with the soybean and other farmers, right? He's proposed another $16 billion credit, subsidy to them, and $12 billion last year, and who knows how much next year, an election year. It can be $40, $50 billion to the farm sector. He'll do the same with the Mexican trade, which impacts mostly, Texas and California, to some extent, Illinois and Michigan with the auto parts and so forth. So he'll throw some money around. He'll try to get Congress to pay for some of that, too. But then he'll throw other money around, I think, to placate for 1 year until he gets reelected. You see, everything this guy does is for reelection purposes. And he doesn't really care what impact it has on the country, especially on consumers and workers and small businesses.
I know how angry my son and other folks are going to be when their guacamole becomes more expensive. But looking at spending bills originate, most spending bills originate in the House of Representatives, a democratically controlled House. I would expect a lot of pushback from Democrats in the House if Donald Trump tries to cross the line between the responsibility of the executive branch to execute law. The House is designed to originate law and the spending power.
Yes, very clearly, U.S. Constitution, the House of Representatives has the spending power. In other words, it initiates spending bills and legislation. Well, you know, in so much other ways, Trump is bypassing the House. That's part of this constitutional crisis. You know, he won't allow his people, even if subpoenaed, to appear before the House. The only way the House is going to get people to appear is to initiate impeachment proceedings, which the leadership of the House, Pelosi, Schumer, and Schumer in the Senate don't want to do. So what will be the response of the Democrats in the House to this move by Trump if he keeps, which he will, if he keeps tariffs on Mexico? It remains to be seen. Of course, we have, the ratification of the previous negotiation with Mexico and Canada, you know, NAFTA 2.0 or called USMCA bill, right?
Right.
What will they do there? I don't think they'll hold that up. I think they'll go through with that anyway. They probably should hold it up. But, you know, I don't see the leadership in the House really being that all aggressive in confronting Trump and trying to change his policies. I think, there's a lot of huff and puff and smoke and mirrors, and you won't see a lot of real action from the House.
I'm sorry to jump in here. We just have about a minute and a half left, and I want to be sure I get your take on this. Looking at this from the Mexico political side, AMLO, the president in Mexico, is trying to cut a pretty thin line here. As you look at the polling on the Mexico side, they don't want him to cave into Trump.
No, there's a contradiction there for Mexico. The Mexican people are very sensitive about, U.S. Imperialist economic measures here. So that's a problem AMLO has. But you see, AMLO, 80% of all their exports go to the U.S.
Right. That's his problem. Right.
And Mexico is slipping into a recession right now.
It's almost, and we got to wrap up here, it's almost Mexico saying, well, really, Trump, what do you want me to do? When you look at the policies that they're already implementing, the number of people that they're already housing in Mexico as people are waiting, they're in staging areas as people are waiting to come here. I mean, Mexico's, I think, doing a pretty Herculean task with very limited resources. So it'll be very interesting to see what it is that Trump is really, I mean, you can't squeeze blood from a stone.
Well, you know, if the U.S. can't stop the immigration from Central America by building walls and all the other technology and everything it uses, can you just imagine how hard it is for Mexico?
There you go.
With a larger border, which is all jungle virtually,
right.
You know, Guerrero, Chiapas and so forth. I mean, it's almost impossible for Mexico to stop these people.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, I got to stop you there. It's easier for me to stop you than it is for Mexico to stop them.
Or Trump raising tariffs.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, as always, thank you so much for your insight and for your contribution to the Critical Hour.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Jack. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Senators look to force 22 votes blocking arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She's executive manager at STAND, the student-led movement to end mass atrocities, Mac Hamilton. Mac, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thanks so much, Wilmer. Glad to be here.
So we have a bipartisan group of senators led by Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey, the top Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, and of all people, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, a Trump ally and sycophant, and once a staunch defender of the Saudi kingdom, trying to force nearly two dozen votes rebuking the Trump administration's decision to declare a national emergency to circumvent Congress and sell billions of dollars of munitions to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. What does this say to you?
Right. So this is a really interesting moment. So as you mentioned, on May 24th, there was a national security declaration around this arms sale. And, you know, historically, this has only happened, I believe, four times where the administration has tried to circumvent Congress in order to pass an arms sale. And again, historically, this is only Congress has only successfully blocked a sale once, and that was in 1986. And that was also for an arms sale to Saudi Arabia during the Reagan administration. So this is a very interesting moment. Congress has repeatedly rebuked the president for the ongoing relationship with Saudi Arabia, which is problematic in many ways, but one of which is because of their atrocities that they're committing in Yemen. So that's really the bulk of this. And as you mentioned, Senator Graham is also leading this charge, along with two other Republicans, Todd Young and Rand Paul. And Graham's interest in this largely comes from the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in October. And the president has refused to submit proof that Saudi Arabia did not order the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, which Congress has ordered. So that's really where Graham's coming from in all of this. And then, of course, there's the Yemen aspect as well.
Does the fact that sales have only been blocked once before, does this underscore and highlight the power of the defense lobby, the power of the Lockheed Martins and the Raytheons and the Boeings of the world?
Sure. I mean, I think that's a big part of it. And I think also there's just kind of a longstanding tradition that the executive branch has control over national security matters. And that's something that, especially in the age of Trump, Congress is really looking at more closely than we've seen, because I think there's just a general mistrust given some of the more radical and rash actions the president seems willing to take in both domestic and foreign policy.
It is reported that this ire of the Senate underscores lawmakers' fury at the administration's support for the Saudis after the killing of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Never mind that the Saudis, with assistance from the U.S., are indiscriminately killing Yemenis. And you touched on this. It's really about Khashoggi after buses of children being vaporized by Saudi missiles being shot from fighter planes and all of the atrocities that are being committed in Yemen?
Right. I mean, I wish it didn't take the murder of one individual to get Congress to act on this. But really, activists had been discussing this for a long time before the murder of Khashoggi, and especially on the Republican side, hadn't had a lot of luck getting Republicans on board until that unfortunate event happened. And I think that really just kind of underlines the fact that the public and members of Congress as well care a lot more about the lives of U.S. residents than they do about others, particularly civilians around the world who don't have a voice in our policymaking processes. So to remind listeners, Jamal Khashoggi was a columnist with The Washington Post. And I think that connection to a U.S. media outlet was very important to changing the tide on this.
And Trump, now, he circumvented Congress last month by declaring an emergency over Iran and moving forward with the arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Jordan. He's claimed an emergency down at the southern border with Mexico and is trying to circumvent spending, congressional spending processes with that. With all these emergency declarations, he's quickly becoming the boy who cried wolf because he's calling emergencies on situations that he himself created.
Right. And it's very frustrating, especially because some of the policy responses are very clear, right? And he's, you know, while he's declaring this emergency on the southern border, concurrently, he's, you know, putting trade restrictions in place with Mexico that might keep migrants from trying to reach the United States by the southern border. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of poor policy making happening. And, you know, he really is trying to circumvent Congress through all of these emergency declarations, unfortunately. And I think that that, you know, it really highlights the fact that we have allowed legislation to go through for many, many years with these cutouts for quote unquote national emergencies. And, you know, I haven't done the research into this, but, you know, it's reminiscent of a lot of the policies passed after 9/11, really allowing the executive branch to take a lot more power for supposed national emergency purposes.
So at the end of the day, senators looking to force 22 votes blocking arms sales to Saudi Arabia, Robert Menendez and Lindsey Graham, they aren't shrinking violets. These are two pretty powerful senators from each side of the aisle. Is this just going to wind up being Trump being slapped on his hand, putting his hand in his pocket and moving forward?
We'll have to see. So, you know, it only takes a simple majority to launch debates on each of these sales. So it at least can slow up the process and take a lot of debate time over the next couple of months. And I think that that's a plus. And I think that that sends a message to Saudi Arabia and the UAE that Congress is watching. And I think that that should concern them when it comes to long-term support from the U.S. government. You know, inshallah, President Trump won't be in power forever. And, you know, both Saudi Arabia and UAE should be looking for the future of their relationship with the United States. So I think that that's something I'd say. Another thing, however, is that, you know, Trump can veto each of these resolutions should he so choose. So we still would need a veto-proof majority for this to actually mean anything. So, you know, for the senators who are leading this charge, those of us in the advocacy community would really urge them to also be passing through the National Defense Authorization Act provisions to end arms sales in whole. And Jack Reed is one of the seven senators leading this push on the resolution of disapproval, and he's also the lead Democrat on the NDAA process. So Jack Reed could really make a huge difference by also pushing this in the NDAA.
Mac Hamilton, executive manager at STAND, the student-led movement to end mass atrocities. It's also going to be important to see what MSNBC and CNN do with this, how they champion this, or whether they do it all. Mac Hamilton, as always, thank you so much for your contribution to The Critical Hour.
Great. Thank you so much.
Look forward to having you back. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The Trump administration imposes new travel restrictions on Cuba, banning cruise ships. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He is co-coordinator at the United National Anti-War Coalition, Joe Lombardo. Joe, welcome to The Critical Hour.
Thank you.
So the U.S. announced major new restrictions on U.S. citizens traveling to Cuba late yesterday, blocking the most common way Americans are able to visit the island through organized tour groups that license U.S. citizens to travel automatically and banning U.S. cruise ships from stopping in the country. American tourism is not explicitly permitted in Cuba. However, Americans can travel if it's covered under specific category or was covered under specific categories, which included organized group travel known as people to people until yesterday. Commercial flights from the U.S. will continue to be permitted as they broadly support family travel and other lawful forms of travel, according to an administrative Trump person. Is President Trump taking us through Groundhog Day?
He's taking us back to a period where there were stricter sanctions and stricter restrictions against travel, with travel to Cuba. I don't know if I'd call it Groundhog Day. I think he's forging his own path.
How then is this different from whence we've come prior to the Obama administration, since the restrictions were loosened during the Obama administration?
Yes, they were loosened to some extent during the Obama administration, and the Cubans were glad to have that. And it allowed more people to travel to Cuba, and actually millions from the United States. I understand it's been over 2 million have traveled to Cuba. And so this restricts them. They've had prior restrictions on the amount of money that Cubans can send back to their families. And I think they're trying more to isolate the island. I think they're trying more to create economic hardship. And that economic hardship really translates down to the people. And that should be a crime. But at base, I think the United States does not want the people of our country to go and see what is really happening in Cuba. They want them to just know Cuba through the narrative that the government and the State Department gives. And for those of us who have been to Cuba, that narrative is totally wrong. It has nothing to do with what is happening on the island or the government or the people of Cuba.
In fact, I think it was Cuba's president who just said, we're not about to succumb to this pressure. We've been under sanctions from America for the last 60 years. You're not getting anything from us.
Yeah, that's true. Cuba's been through extremely hard times after the fall of the Soviet Union, what they call their special period. They didn't have crops that could feed their entire country, and they had to do very creative ways to feed people. And it was very difficult for the people during that time, but they came through it, and they developed these creative ways. They developed urban agriculture. They diversified their agriculture throughout the entire country, and now they're doing things like going to Venezuela and showing the Venezuelans how they did that. So Cuba will survive, there's no doubt about it, because the political consciousness of the Cuban people are such that they're not going to ever move backwards in their revolution.
You mentioned Venezuela. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said in the statement that the restrictions are a result of Cuba committing to play a destabilizing role in the Western Hemisphere, providing a communist foothold in the region, and propping up U.S. adversaries in places like Venezuela and Nicaragua by fomenting instability, undermining the rule of law, and suppressing democratic processes. A communist foothold in the region, fomenting instability, undermining the rule of law, and suppressing democratic processes. Talk about the pot calling the kettle black, as you just did. That is laughable.
Yeah. Well, Venezuelans consider their process a socialist process. They believe they're moving in a direction of socialism, and they believe that they are providing for the needs of the poorest people. The United States and Wall Street do not want to see that. They want to see the resources, the extensive resources of Venezuela, be used to make profit for the exceedingly rich in the United States. In terms of democracy, their process, their elections are about the most democratic you can imagine. They have a separate part of government, an elected official, that elected person that runs their electoral commission. It's separate from the parties, it's separate from the rest of the government. And in their constitution, they have a mandate that that particular branch of government has to do everything it can to make sure that everybody has the right to vote. We don't have anything like that in our own constitution. In their last election, their president, Maduro won by about 70% of the vote. Our president, of course, lost the popular vote, and yet they consider that undemocratic and what we have as democratic. And Cuba has every right as a sovereign nation to trade with and support in any way it wants any other government in the world, and to try to thwart that is the height of hypocrisy for the United States to say that they don't have that right, and that's democracy. So I don't think so at all. It is true, in my opinion, that the United States does not want to see Venezuela succeed, and Cuba is helping Venezuela succeed, and that is part of what is at base of these new sanctions.
You talked about elections in Cuba. How much of this is really geared towards the older Euro-Cuban demographic in Florida, who's also very aligned with European or white Venezuelans, as we move towards the 2020 election? Because the kind of the de facto leader in terms of U.S. policy in this regard is none other than Florida Senator Little Marco Rubio.
It might be that what Trump has in mind is to try to win over some of the right-wing Latino votes. However, the majority of Latinos throughout the country, whether they come from Central America, South America, Mexico, Puerto Rico, are, you know, politically kind of progressive and left-leaning. So he's not going to make many gains with the Latino community this way. And even among the Cuban population, there's been a change over the years, and people are more willing to have an open relationship with Cuba and are probably very angry at the new restrictions in terms of the money and travel that can happen with Cuba. So I don't know that this is a winning strategy for him in 2020.
In fact, to your point, and we'll wrap up here, to your point, the demographic data from the two Obama elections showed that older Cubans voted Republican. Their children and many of their grandchildren were voting Democrat. Many attribute a lot of that to how Obama was able to hold Florida both times.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And I think that's the trend.
I think that's the trend. And to your point, I think on this one, they are, as they would say on the corner, hustling backwards on this one.
They always hustle backwards.
Somehow, some way. Joe Lombardo, co-coordinator, United National Anti-War Coalition. Thank you for your analysis today. Thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour, and look forward to having you back.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Over GOP build the wall shouts and sabotage efforts, House Democrats pass historic bill to shield dreamers from Trump deportation force. After years of GOP refusal, the House finally voted on the DREAM Act under a Democrat majority. The bill, H.R. 6, passed by a vote of 237 to 187, with just 7 Republicans voting yes. What does this mean going forward? And is this as historic as reported? For insight into this, we turn to my next guests. First, co-founder and executive director of Alianza Americas, dedicated to improving the quality of life of Latino immigrant communities in the U.S. as well as peoples throughout the Americas, Oscar Cachon. Oscar, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Pleasure to be with you again. Thank you for inviting me.
Also, a nationally known immigrant rights activist, co-founder of the Latinx organization Mi Gente, and a community organizer with the Northwest Detention Center Resistance, Ms. Maru Mora Villapando. Maru, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you again.
Maru, let me start with you. Is the passing in the House of H.R. 6 as significant as is being reported?
Well, it is. Politically speaking, yes. Obviously, we are in a phase of this fascist regime where there's no expectations of anything moving at a federal level. Obviously, the House has a little bit more of control with Democrats. Even then, you know, with all the differences amongst the same Democrats. I mean, the difficulty will be obviously in the Senate and obviously with the president. I think that to me personally, the significance of moving this bill is the fact that grassroots groups were able to pressure Democrats to not cave in and allow, as usually has happened in every legislation in regards to immigration, to have the very xenophobic, very racist parts of the bill that end up really just creating more harm than good. At the end of the day, reform is not the solution. We are very clear in the fact that what we need is a complete abolition of the detention system and the deportation system. But I think politically speaking, it does reflect the growth of grassroots movements within the very mainstream immigrant rights movement that was the end of the 90s and the beginning of the 2000s.
Oscar Cachon, same question to you.
Well, I very much agree with Maru just said. I mean, I believe it is a victory mainly from the point of view of having a dissonant event to the dominant reality of Trump driving the discourse, driving the narrative, and Republicans going along with it. So it is even interesting to see that there were 7 Republicans who actually voted for this particular bill. And again, I agree with Maru. The difficulties are going to be both in the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, and of course, the president. But I believe that it does represent an important breakthrough, partly because I have been for long of the opinion that we have a much better chance in the future to actually crack the crazy immigration policy totally centered on repressive measures against immigrants by going piece by piece, pieces like the DACA recipients, pieces like the TPS recipients, and several other specific groups that you can identify, than any realistic chance of passing anything that could amount to a so-called comprehensive immigration reform, which in my view was the very dominant logic for nearly 20 years, and in many ways is what has brought us to where we are today. So I'm hopeful that this event is symbolic in the end, but very, very meaningful precisely because of the larger political context in which we are in today.
Ms. Maura Villalpando, with the success of this in the House, and we're looking at 2020, does this energize immigrant rights groups, and does it also signal to the Democrats a positive political group that they really need to pay more attention to?
I think in a way it does. I think that, you know, there's all this point of view in the United States that everything gets solved through policy, that everything gets solved by politicians, and therefore our role is just to elect politicians that agree with us. We believe that's wrong. That's just one piece of the pie. But something that has been clear since the last presidential election is that a lot of people don't agree with the politics of the Democrats. I think that it's great that the kind of new politicians elected in the last electoral elections that bring young women of color into the mainstream of the Democratic Party to push the Democratic Party to the left, I think it's what really is more meaningful here. I think that's what is energizing other people that don't feel that the Democratic Party reflects any of the things they want to get done. Obviously not the Republicans, of course, either. But I think that at the end of the day is what kind of people are we electing and how we're keeping them accountable. That is the most important part. And part of how we keep them accountable is also the kind of work we do at the grassroots level. I think that it is the fact that Democrats that were elected to really a big effort of grassroots canvassing, for example, it shows the difference between the structural institution that the Democratic Party has been. I honestly think that it is from the base that politicians will have to end up responding to that base. And obviously this is a good, it's a good step. Yet I am afraid when people believe this is the step or this is the way we're gonna win, I think it's important to remind ourselves this is just one way, but it's not the only way to get to the point of ending detention and deportations and the deaths of immigrants. Policy right now does not address the deaths of people under ICE custody and Border Customs and Border Patrol custody. And that's something we've been saying for a really long time.
Oscar Cachon, same question. Policy output is supposed to be one of the purposes of politics. So does this success, as limited as it is, does it send a signal?
It's a very early signal, a ray of hope, if you want. But I personally believe that far more needs to be done if the Democratic Party is going to, number one, put forward a good, inspiring candidate, and two, one that will be able to connect with the larger Latino immigrant population and Latino population in general. The reality is that the past 25 years or so have been a steady assault on the very idea that Latinos don't belong here, that Latinos are a burden, that Latinos are a threat. And to the extent that that view has led the Democratic Party to be extremely lukewarm in as far as embracing a truly counter-narrative and a counter-set of proposals, I think that that explains why there has been lack of support. So in my view, the vote yesterday is, as Maru said, you know, one step in the right direction. And I also echo very strongly the principle that you do not build democracy and an engaged population just by observing the legislative process in D.C. It takes a lot of work, especially at the grassroots level. And that's where we need to understand that in the end, the difference will be made. But again, I insist, I really believe that we are far from having truly clear signals about a new, totally asymmetrical strategy on the part of the Democrats. We should begin by recognizing that from all over the world, but especially from Latin American countries, are a true reward for the nation. They are people we could not do without. And we are to be supported, celebrated, and not punished and persecuted as the case it is now.
That's the voice of Oscar Cachon, co-founder and executive director of Alianza Americas. And we were also very fortunate to have with us Ms. Maru Mora Villapando, co-founder of the Latinx organization Mi Gente and a community organizer with Northwest Detention Center Resistance. Thank you both for your analysis and for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you all back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Cosmetics retailer Sephora to close all stores for diversity training after singer SZA tweets about racial profiling. Sephora says it will close all of its stores today so employees across the country can undergo diversity training. The move comes after singer SZA said she was profiled at a Sephora in Calabasas, California. Does diversity training really work? And is this the solution to this systemic global problem? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest, historian, publisher of Acumen Magazine, and author of In Search of Purity, Eugenics, and Racial Uplift Among New Negroes, 1915 and 1935, Dr. Chantella Sherman. Chantella, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Thank you. And we're also joined by SiriusXM host of Career Mix, human capital strategist focused on the art of recruiting diverse talent using various creative methods. He's the author of Rip the Resume, Job Search and Interview Power Prep. Torrin Ellis. Torrin, welcome to the Critical Hour.
And definitely a pleasure to be with you.
So let me start with you, Dr. Sherman. When situations like this occur, we hear a lot of discussion about diversity training. Does it really work, and is it the solution to what I consider to be a systemic problem?
It can be. And I say that as someone who actually does diversity training. However, I do it in a very using eugenics and using pop culture. The problem a lot of times is that the culture of diversity is not intrinsic. It's not within the organizations themselves. So if you look perhaps at Sephora, you may not see diversity at its upper realms. You may not see it in its management. You may not see it in any other area. And then you try and get folks that are on the ground dealing with customers to be diverse. And so if that's not in the climate and the culture of the corporation itself, then basically what you're talking about is please be nice to the customers so that we can get their money. But we're not necessarily concerned with diversity in and of itself. So it has to have legs. It has to have volume. And sometimes when you do the training, a lot of it is talking to management and corporate heads. That's the way I do it, so that there's a trickle down. Please understand that Sephora is like many other places. I used to shop there. I stopped because I realized as a customer, I can get the same products. I'm an Urban Decay user. I can get that at Nordstrom's Rack. So I don't have to go into Sephora. And I think they're starting to understand that with Amazon and other outlets, it's easier for the person to actually go to the makeup brand that they want and order that online rather than having to deal with poor customer service or folks who are profiling them and actually calling the police, believing that they're stealing high-end products that aren't necessarily high-end anywhere else.
Torrin Ellis, you're a human capital strategist. Same question to you. Does diversity training work? My years long in another life on the corporate America side, when I heard diversity training, that was usually Taco Tuesday so that you could get an appreciation for the Hispanic culture. And we'd also then have some Chinese people bring in some Chinese food.
Yeah, so it can work. It just depends on how the information is delivered and how so incredibly sincere the organization really is. $8 billion a year is spent on diversity training. And so if you look at organizations and the representation of the underrepresented, especially at the higher levels in the organization, one might walk away and say, or many will walk away and say, it does not work. Researchers at the Wharton School just released a report this week, Dr. Leon, that simply said, in quote, a lot of companies are doing these things because they think they work, but we don't have any evidence to support that. That was actually said by Edward Chang, who a doctoral candidate who led that research. So what I would say to you is that it can work, but it really depends on how serious the organization is. And that seriousness has to, number one, come from the highest levels of leadership.
You're chuckling, Dr. Sherman. Why? Do we need to call a candidate Chang's committee and have his research checked?
I'm still tickled by your Taco Tuesday comment. Oh. And yeah, so
am I wrong?
That's kind of where I am. Well, I think that a lot of times is the problem. When you start talking diversity, you automatically make people cringe because it's as if you're accusing them of something. But again, if you have folks of color in management, then that automatically, again, sometimes it trickles down. You understand how you're supposed to treat people and what the cultural climate is of the corporation based upon how your management sometimes deals with folks as they're coming in, how they deal with the workers in many instances, who many times are of color. And so if you're being told, you know, look out for these people or watch out for these folks, you know, that's the attitude that you tend to take. And sometimes the problem is, the person who's surveying you is also a person of color. And so that, again, when we start talking bias and diversity training, you have to do it in a way that eliminates the usual suspects. You understand? So that's why I said when I do it, I talk about eugenics and breaking down all of those barriers that we automatically put into place that go to race and entitlement and bias.
And Torrin, in my introduction, I talked about this being a systemic problem. Remember, billionaire media mogul Oprah Winfrey says she was a victim of racism on a 2013 trip to Switzerland when a shop assistant refused to show her a handbag because it was too expensive for Oprah. She was in Zurich for Tina Turner's wedding. So it's not just a U.S. problem. It is a systemic international problem. Your thoughts?
Well, again, the bottom line is oftentimes when these trainings are deployed inside of the organization, it's the subpopulation who tends to change their behaviors. We feel like we can, to use the popular phrase, we want to lean in a little bit more. We want to be a bit more affirming, and we want to help push this matter forward, where in many of these instances, it's the white men that are in power that are not helping to move, nor are they changing how they think about diversity and inclusion. What I've often said, Dr. Leon, is that this is not about skill. This is more about will. Will versus skill. And so if you wish to be better at diversity and inclusion, if you wish to really take something away from the certification or the training, then you will do that. The last thing that I'll say is that too many people in the organization lean either on the business methodology, the business case, or they lean on the social imperative, and they don't have a connection between the two. And so without that connection, I still think that 5 years from now, 3 years from now, we'll still be having the very same conversation.
I think you're right. Dr. Chantella Sherman, you know, the thing that I want to ask these folks that are engaging in these practices and in these thoughts is, why do you think that African-American man in that golf shirt and shorts can't afford to buy a Mercedes? Why do you think that African-American woman or that Hispanic, that Latinx woman coming in here with this handbag is about to try to steal everything off this counter? What is it that makes you think this? Getting back, I think, to your eugenics discussion.
Okay, I think it's something that's taught. It's something that's ingrained. We're taught through television, through pop culture, in our households sometimes, who to believe is the culprit. And so, again, if we go to the Clarks years ago with the doll test, we're taught from the time we're very small who the culprits are, who to look for, who to survey. And so that doesn't change unless we change it sometimes as adults.
That's the voice of historian, publisher of Acumen Magazine, and author of In Search of Purity, Eugenics and Racial Uplift Among New Negroes, 1915 to 1935, Dr. Chantella Sherman. And we were also very fortunate to be joined by human capital strategist and author of Rip the Resume, Job Search and Interview Power Prep, as well as SiriusXM host of Career Mix, Torin Ellis. Thank you all both for your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Look forward to having you all back. Thank you. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Russian aircraft intercepts U.S. aircraft three times. A Russian aircraft intercepted a U.S. aircraft multiple times yesterday in what is being called an unprovoked and irresponsible act, according to a statement from the U.S. Sixth Fleet. The statement says that the second interception was unsafe because the Russian aircraft conducted a high-speed pass directly in front of the mission aircraft, putting the pilots and crew at risk of a mid-air collision. The Russian military today disputed the U.S. Navy's characterization of the intercept as unsafe. Quote, all flights of Russian aircraft were carried out in accordance with the international rules for the use of airspace, the Russian Ministry of Defense told reporters today. There were no questions or complaints from the American Center of Flight Deconfliction Line in Syria to the Russian command. I want to know, first of all, was this reported on the Russian side? How is it being reported if it was? And for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's an international affairs and security analyst. He is in Russia, Mark Sloboda. Mark, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Hi, thanks for having me on. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on the Critical Hour.
So whenever I read stories like this, my antennas of skepticism go up and my radar goes on. And so my first question to you was, is this being reported? And if so, how?
Yeah, it's being reported, of course. It's being reported in almost identical terms to the way it's being reported in the U.S., with the exception that there is perhaps stronger remarks from focus on the remarks from the Russian government saying that it wasn't a full compliance with the international rules and regulations governing passage in international airspace, and more focus on noting the dangers present to Russia's military bases in Syria. This is where this intercept took place. The U.S. aircraft, it was a P-8A Poseidon reconnaissance aircraft, a spy plane, that flew at the very limits of the Syrian border, where American aircraft are now flying on an essentially daily basis, probing Russia's naval base at Tartus and their air base at Khmeimim in Syria. And why this is so dangerous is because the Khmeimim air base in particular has come under regular attack by jihadists out of the Idlib area, which is completely controlled by al-Qaeda and its allies like the Turkestan Islamic Party. Regular attacks, drone attacks, and the Russian government has noted before that these attacks are increasingly be carrying out with seeming to have intelligence, sophistication, and orchestration and organization far beyond what could be the capabilities of a bunch of jihadis in Idlib.
In the past, Mark, and I think you used the term either pushing the envelope or close to the edge. I think you used one of those two phrases. And isn't that, or I know it was at one point, a common practice to fly real close to the edge to get a sense of response time, scramble time, all of those types of things. So this is common practice, not only by Russian aircraft, but it's the Americans and others as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a legacy of the Cold War that has become the norm again in the last, I would say, 8 years or so, and increasingly up-tempo. I mean, it continues to increase the number of such instances that are going on. Russia in May flew a number of bombers off the coast of Alaska. In March, the U.S. flew B-52s and made mock nuclear attacks in the Baltic Sea just off the Russian coast, as if they were conducting nuclear cruise missile attacks on Russian soil. And the U.S. is regularly, I mean, we're talking nearly every 2 weeks, the U.S. has spy planes that are probing the Black Sea and the Baltic Sea, which are, of course, very, very far, you know, on the other side of the world from the United States. And it's right on Russia's borders in sensitive areas. And while Russia certainly is not, they are responding simply because of geography and military capability, they are responding much less frequently than what the U.S. is doing, simply if for no other reason than they lack the geography and the capability to conduct regular such out of foreign military bases close to U.S. borders and so on.
Mark, I find it interesting that the Russian response says in part, there were no questions or complaints from the American Center of Flight Deconfliction Line in Syria to the Russian command. Usually in situations like this, wouldn't there be some type of communication, some radio communication between the aircrafts involved? Has any radio communication between them, any text of such, been released? Because this also then made me think about the allegations of Iranian sabotage of or attacks on tankers in the Persian Gulf, which later proved to be less than accurate. All of this just seemed to me to be U.S. provocation in trying to heighten U.S. Citizen sensibility to the big Russian boogeyman.
Yeah, actually, that the reference to deconfliction lines, that's actually Russia trolling the United States there. What they're mentioning is there are deconfliction lines in Syria for the U.S. and Russian Air Force, because the Russian Air Force is there legally in Western Syria at the request of the, under international law, under the request of the UN-recognized Syrian government, while the United States is illegally militarily occupying all of East Syria, east of the Euphrates, and that includes control of their aircraft. And there are deconfliction lines between the two military set up for the flights of aircraft within Syria. But of course, this doesn't include spy planes probing Russia's military bases right on the coast, right? Obviously, a spy plane is not, you know, something that the two militaries chat about on a deconfliction line. So that comment is actually Russia trolling the U.S. military there. What Russia's really concerned about is the potential for attacks on Russian military bases there. Israel is a U.S. ally, is regularly launching attacks, you know, illegal unilateral attacks into Syria, where it's such become a norm. And they're also worried about these increasing jihadi drone and attempts at mortar attacks on Russia's military bases. And there's a very real fear that's been voiced by the Russian military that the U.S. and or some of its allies are passing on intelligence to, you know, what the Western press still calls often rebels, a rebel stronghold. But even the U.S. government admits Hayat Tahrir al-Sham controls Idlib, and Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, as even the U.S. government recognizes, is al-Qaeda.
So is this much ado about nothing or?
No.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, this is not much ado about nothing. This is, from the Russian side at least, this is deadly serious. This is a real danger to their military bases and their military personnel in a conflict zone where Russian military personnel are dying. And there was just an incident during an Israeli attack several months ago that resulted in the shooting down in crossfire of a Russian military aircraft and the loss of all hands on board. So this is deadly serious for the Russian side. And they're sending a message to the U.S. It is possible that Russia was obviously flying too close for comfort for the U.S. spy plane. And at the same time, they were following international rules, as the U.S. was. But Russia was letting the U.S. know that these routine spy planes probing their defenses in Syria are not wanted and will not be tolerated.
And it's a dangerous, game to play.
Tensions, conflicts, it's all going very high.
Got it. Well, Mark Sloboda, International Affairs and Security Analyst, thank you so much for your time and staying up this evening this late. Really appreciate it. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened, and I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.